fear. It's not so much that we're afraid to change, or so in love with the old ways, but it's that place in between that we fear. It's like being in between trapezes. It's Linus when his blanket is in the dryer. There's nothing to hold on to. You know what that feeling of fear is like? Panic sweeps over you. Anxiety rises in your heart. You can't stop your heart. It won't slow down. Your breathing is heavy. You're in between. You have nothing to hang on to. Your blanket is in the dryer. That's exactly how the disciples felt prior to Matthew chapter 28. They had watched their Lord and Master submit himself to all of these soldiers, the temple guards, the Roman soldiers. They watched Jesus submit to them and then walk away handcuffed. They heard about this mock Jewish trial. They saw the wounds on Jesus as he left the praetorium marching up to Golgotha. And they saw their Lord hanging on the cross. And all of their hopes and all of their dreams and all of their longings was dying. They had nothing to hang on to. But you know what? Just a few days later, these same men willingly and eagerly stood before the same council, the Sanhedrin, that had sentenced Jesus to death. This Sanhedrin had commanded them not to speak anymore about this Jesus. And they said, "Judge for yourselves whether it is right in God's sight to obey you rather than God. For we cannot help speak about what we have seen and heard." There was a change. There was a transformation. There was a radical transformation in the lives of James, of Peter and John. So changed that they turned the world upside down. What was it? What had they seen? What had they heard that made such a dramatic difference in their life? It was the resurrection. They saw and they heard the one who they saw dying on the hillside, now alive. The big idea this morning is this: Jesus' resurrection transforms cowardice to courage, fear to faith. Because it's in the resurrection of Jesus that we have something to hang on to. Now, as we look at Matthew chapter 28, there is a somber mood entering into this chapter. Because not only is Jesus dead, not only has Jesus been buried, but the Romans have posted a guard to make sure that nobody messes with this tomb. It's early in the morning. Matthew tells us, verse 1, after the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. Now Matthew is very cryptic, very brief, very succinct, because he wants to get to the main thing. He doesn't waste a lot of time telling us about detail, but some of the detail is important, and thankfully the Lord has provided us with three other accounts so that we can harmonize this wonderful event and look with greater clarity what exactly happened. John tells us that these ladies left before it was light. They're up early, early on Sunday morning. What we would call Sunday morning, aren't we? Actually, according to how the Jews reconciled their day, this was in the middle of their Sunday. See, the Sabbath ended Saturday night, 6 o'clock. So 12 hours later, these ladies are up. They are traveling to the tomb. Mark tells us that the sun has already come up. Matthew just tells us that it's dawn. Matthew tells us that there are two ladies here, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, unidentified other than saying the other Mary. He mentions these two ladies because if you look up in verse 61 and again in verse 56 of the previous chapter, these ladies are mentioned. Matthew's telling us these are the ladies that saw Jesus die. These are the same ladies who saw where Jesus was buried. These are the same ladies who went to the tomb that Sunday morning. There's no mistake going to the wrong tomb. These ladies know exactly where they are going. But if we look at some of the other accounts, we find from Luke's account, particularly chapter 24, that there are three ladies mentioned. Mark mentions yet another lady by name. So we have five ladies mentioned by name, and Luke tells us there are other women, plural, that are with Mary and the other Mary going to the tomb. Now, we don't know how many women there are, but let's say that there are eight. We don't know that. That's an arbitrary number for just so that you have a picture in your mind that there's a small group of women who are going to the tomb on this particular Sunday. Now, we don't know why they went. Matthew doesn't waste any space or any ink telling us why did they go to the tomb. Mark does. Mark chapter 16, verse 1 tells us that they went in order to anoint the body of Jesus. You remember, Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus had to hurry in order to bury Jesus. He died at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon, and before the Sabbath started at 6 o'clock that afternoon, they had to finish all of the burial procedures. He had to go to Pilate, get permission to take down the body. They had to send a centurion to make sure that he was dead. Centurion went back to Pilate. Pilate says, yes, the guy's dead. Pilate says to Joseph, yes, you can take the body. They take the body down. They have to wrap it in all of these burial spices and all of this linen, all before 6 o'clock. All of that got done, but it was so hurried. These women who loved Jesus so much didn't have the opportunity to mourn and to grieve and to just spend time at that burial site. And so I'm convinced that early on that Saturday, that Sunday morning, they got up, went to the tomb in order to weep and mourn the loss of their Lord, the loss of their master. And they knew that there was a stone in front of this tomb. I'm sure that they figured somehow we're going to get somebody to help us to get this thing out of the way. They probably didn't know that there were Roman soldiers posted at the tomb. You remember that they were posted on Saturday night, or sometime Saturday, we don't know exactly when. They didn't know about that. But you know what? When these ladies turned the corner and they came to that tomb, their eyes became like pie tins. They were huge. Consider, just a second, what went on just before their eyes laid on all of this scene that happened. There was, according to Matthew, a violent earthquake. Now, we don't know when that happened. We suspect, gives us a detail, we suspect that that symboled when Jesus rose from the dead. We don't know that exactly. It may have been that the ladies were walking to the tomb when they felt a tremor. Could be. We don't know. We do know that there was an angel who descended rolled back the stone, not to let Jesus out, but to let the other people in. He rolled back the stone and he was sitting on that stone. Tomb was empty by this point. So when these ladies turned the corner and they looked and saw what they saw, the first thing was that they saw this spirit being in bodily form. It tells us in verse 4 that the guards were so afraid that they shook and they became like dead men. Now think about that. Matthew doesn't spend any time right here in this passage that we're going to look at this morning talking about the guards. We talked about them last week. We'll talk about them next week. But these guards witnessed the empty tomb. They witnessed the angel. They witnessed the earthquake. They saw it all. They were eyewitnesses of this miraculous event. And they stood there frozen and they shook like dead men. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't say anything. These ladies, the first thing they saw was this guy sitting on a rock. His clothes were brighter than any bleach you've ever used. They probably wished they had their sunglasses at that point. The second thing they saw after they noticed this angel was that the stone was rolled away. There's nothing inside. It's empty from what they can see. And they noticed the guards. They were shaking. Matthew doesn't take the time here, but we find from John's gospel that Mary Magdalene runs away. At this point, she saw that the tomb had been messed with. And she ran away to tell the other disciples. We'll get to Mary Magdalene in just a minute. Matthew simply says, he's talking about some of these other women that are standing there at the tomb. Verse 5, the angel speaks to them. Now what's happening to these women? They are probably in the same posture that these guards were. Just kind of standing there, shaking, wondering, what's going on here? And the angel speaks directly to the women and he says, don't be afraid. I know that you're looking for Jesus, but he's not here. He's risen just as he said. Now, come and see where the place where they laid him, and then go tell his disciples he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you'll see him. Now I've told you. Now from Matthew's gospel, you'd get the impression that there was just one angel, the one sitting on the rock. Well, there was an angel sitting on the rock, but there wasn't just one angel. We know that there were at least two angels outside the tomb, and now we find that there's another angel inside the tomb. As we look at Mark's gospel, it may be that there were three, maybe that one of these angels walked inside. We don't know. It doesn't matter. Mark chapter 16, look at verse 5. These ladies entered the tomb. Remember, the first angel sitting on the rock said, come and see the place where he lay. Verse 5, Mark 16, as they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Well, they were expecting to see a dead body, even though the angel said, he's not here. How could that be? We watched them bury Jesus 3 days ago. How could this be? And the man in the white robe, the angel said, verse 6, don't be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. You know what? That verse encourages me very, very much. Because here these women on the outside of the tomb stood there, or they were standing there, and the angel said to them, come see the place where they laid him, ushering them into the tomb, and this angel there inside the tomb told them the very same things. Are you like that? Sometimes the Lord has to tell you twice, just like sometimes you have to tell your kids twice. Come and see, then go and tell. Look at verse 8 of Mark's gospel. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Now listen here. We've got a group of women that came to the tomb. They were shocked to see what they saw. Mary Magdalene immediately left. She is gone out of the picture. We'll talk about her in a minute. But here you have a handful of women, 6, 7, 8 people maybe. We don't know how many women there were. Let's say that there were 7 left. Some of these ladies came and saw, and then they went and hid. Matthew tells us about some of those other women and their responses. Look back at Matthew's gospel. We looked at verse 5 through 7, what the angel told to the women. They went inside, saw what was there, nothing but the grave clothes and another angel. Verse 8, so the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid, yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Obviously, we've got different responses to this message. Some heard it, and they took their blanket out of the dryer because now they had something to hang on to, and they went right to the disciples to tell them what was going on. Others ran and hid because they still felt as though they were in between two trapeze, not knowing what to hang on to. Now at this point, I'd like to pick up where Mary Magdalene is. Mary Magdalene, look at John chapter 20, verse 1. John chapter 20, verse 1 reads, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb, saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciples, the other disciple, the one Jesus loved. That's John's euphemistic way of saying, that's me. We're talking about John, the Apostle John. And said, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they have put him. Mary left the tomb before the angel spoke to the other ladies. She left out of fear, thinking, oh, they've messed with the tomb. Where is Jesus' body? I've got to tell Peter. I've got to tell John. She leaves. The angel speaks to these other ladies. They look inside. Some run and hide. Others run to tell the disciples. Okay, do you see this pattern here? Now, Mary Magdalene over here has told Peter and John. Now, she is going to motivate them to go to the tomb. And the three of them are going to hightail it back to the tomb. Now, as they do, not only are these women gone, but the angels are gone also. John 20, verse 3. So Peter and the other disciples started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. John was also obviously a little younger, a little more spry, and probably didn't have as much baggage weight-wise to carry. Verse 5, he, that is John, bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. Now, that's amazing. John, we're talking about John here, did not hear anything about any angel. Hadn't heard anything from any resurrected Jesus. Hadn't seen Jesus yet. And all he saw was an empty tomb. There were the grave clothes there, undisturbed. It was as though there was a body there and now it's gone. And indeed, that's exactly what he saw. And he believed. That's faith. Not having to see it, not having to touch it, but simply believing, trusting that what Jesus said was true. John believed it. Look at verse 9. They, that is Peter and Mary, still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. There was a veil, there was a blindness that had overcome them, but soon that'd be taken away. Verse 10, then the disciples went back to their homes. Now that leads me to believe that Peter and John did not go back where all of the other disciples were. They went to their homes, maybe to check in. We don't know what happened. Verse 11, Mary stood outside the tomb crying. All of the other women are gone. The angels are gone. Now Peter and John are gone. And Mary is standing there, absolutely beside herself. She was trying to hang on to something, knowing at least where Jesus' body was laid. And now that's been ripped out from underneath her. And she has nothing, again, to hang on to. And she's just beside herself. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head, the other at the foot. Now these angels weren't there when Peter was in the tomb. But now the angels are in the tomb. And they speak to Mary. They ask her, "Woman, why are you crying?" Notice that she is not shaking like a leaf, like the guards were, like the other women probably were, at the appearance of these angels. Maybe it was because the tears just fogged everything up. But she spoke to them rationally. "They have taken my Lord away," she said. "And I don't know where they've put him." At this, she turned around and she saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't realize that it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it that you're looking for?" Thinking that he was the gardener, brother, was her eyes all clouded up with tears or what, huh? Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've put him. I'll take care of him." Verse 16, Jesus said to her, how did he say her name? Remember, Mary Magdalene was the woman that Jesus cast out seven spirits in. So, did he look at her and call her by name? Like he did the first time he saw her with that air of authority, saying, "Mary?" Or was it that Jesus looked at her and out of that compassionate concern and love just said, "Mary"? We don't know how he said it. I wish we did. But as soon as he said her name, she knew who it was. She knew exactly it was Jesus. Just like he said, he was raised from the dead. He was right there in front of her. And he fell down at his feet, grasped his feet in worship. You said, don't hold on to me, verse 17. I've not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and to your God. Verse 18, Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, I have seen the Lord! And she told them that he had said these things to her. Now at this point, the other disciples not only know that Jesus is alive, that the tomb is empty, but that he has appeared now to Mary. Okay, back in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 28. He first appeared to Mary. These women who had hurried away from the tomb went to the disciples, and on their way to tell Jesus, maybe it was after the fact that they had told the disciples, Jesus suddenly, verse 9, met them. Greetings. I think if it was in this day, Jesus would have said, yo! They came to him and clasped his feet and worshipped him. And then Jesus said, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. That's the third time these ladies are said, I'm risen, or understood, I am risen. Jesus now tells them that in person. Go to Galilee, I'm going to meet everybody else there. Now Jesus doesn't rebuke these women as he did Mary. Did you catch that? Chapter 20, verse 17 of John's Gospel, Jesus says to Mary, don't hang on to me. Don't touch me. Now there are some people that say, well, Mary was simply trying to prove to herself that Jesus was alive bodily. Well, maybe so. I think the more important reason why Jesus told her that is she wanted to linger there in his presence in worship. And Jesus said, you've got a bigger mission. There's something. There's going to be plenty of time for us to spend in worship. But right now, you need to go and tell. The angel said, come and see. Now Jesus says, go and tell. And that woman's life was utterly, completely, and forever transformed. Jesus' resurrection transforms cowardice to courage, fear to faith. It's the resurrection that takes the blanket out of the dryer. It's the resurrection that gives us a grasp on that next trapeze. It's Jesus' resurrection that gives us hope. And my friends, we see it in a variety of different ways. The church's existence is one primary result of the resurrection. The Jews, immediately following this, began to worship on the first day of the week. They broke a tradition of 1,500 years worshiping on the Sabbath, and now they began to do it on the first day of the week. Why? Because of the resurrection. And when we talk about those kinds of things, we haven't even yet begun to talk about the power of the resurrection. We already mentioned Peter and John, whose lives were transformed by the resurrected Christ, who stood before the Sanhedrin saying, you judge for yourselves whether it's right or wrong to speak out. We cannot stop telling about what we've seen and what we've heard. It was the power of the resurrection that allowed Stephen to speak to that same Sanhedrin his wonderful, moving testimony and allowed him to trust in God even at the price of his life. It was the power of the resurrection that allowed Paul to endure many kinds of hardships. He was beaten. He was left for dead. He was abandoned. He was shipwrecked. He was hungry. He was thirsty. His countrymen turned against him. All of this he was able to endure because of the power of the resurrection. All of the disciples, save for John, were martyred for their faith because of the power of the resurrection. We find people dying for their faith all throughout history. But in the 20th century that we just left, more people died in direct relationship to their faith than all of the people that were killed in wars in the 20th century. It's estimated that 165,000 people will be martyred for their faith this year alone. All of these people are able to endure such difficult and demanding circumstances because of the power of the resurrection. Because it gives them hope. It gives them something to hang on to. They can do something that is seemingly impossible because of what God has said is possible by the power of the resurrection. You see, because it's the resurrection that points people to something beyond. Something that has a greater power than what you and I have individually. So that there is nothing for us to fear. What is God calling you to do? To whom is God calling you to reach out? To whom is God calling you to speak boldly? To speak with faith. To speak with courage. You see, it's the resurrection that gives you that strength and that power and that tenacity and that courage and that hope to do what God calls you to do. Even when you don't think you can. Garrison Keillor writes, "When the country goes temporarily to the dogs, cats must learn to be circumspect, walk on fences, sleep in trees, and have faith that all this woofing is not the last word. Hang on, another chapter follows. And the resurrection is that proof that another chapter does indeed follow." Listen to this quote by Ron Sider. I put it in your notes. "Those who understand the empty tomb can afford to lose now. They can afford to treat opponents, even nasty, powerful ones, with civility and respect. Even when they get fed to the lions, whether real ones in the Roman Colosseum or their analogies today, they keep their eye on the prize. In a day or two or a million, the Galilean champion of the weak and the marginalized will return in the twinkling of an eye. He will become the kingdom of our risen Lord." Philippians chapter 3, Paul says, "I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection." Paul says, I want to put everything in my life aside. Anything that anybody else might say is to my credit, should be put on my resume, all these initials after my name, all of that, Paul says, is rubbish. I don't consider any of that stuff worthwhile. What's most important to me? Simply this. I want to know Christ. I want to know the power of his resurrection. So my friends, I ask you, to what is God calling you? To whom is God calling you? That might be something tough, demanding, more than what you think you've got strength and energy, wisdom to do, to accomplish, to proclaim. Resurrection gives you the power and the authority to do what God asks of you. Lord, do everything you want to do in me. So do anything you want to do in me so that I will do everything you want to do through me. Is that your prayer? Write that down. Lord, do anything you want to do in me so that you can do everything you want to do through me. Lord, do anything you want to do in me. Anything. So that you can do everything you want to do through me. The power of the resurrection enables you to do that. It's not your power, it's God's power flowing through you. Maybe for you it'll start with that prayer. That's my prayer. You pray it back to the Lord as I pray it. Would you? Lord, you have proved your faithfulness. Faithfulness to keep your word that goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. You have proved yourself faithful again and again and again. And the resurrection is that exclamation point par excellence that says, yes, I will do what I say I will do. Father, you prove that you are the sovereign Lord. But I also read in Scripture that you choose to use your people to accomplish your will. God, I don't get that. Because I look at myself and I see failure. I see a person unprepared, a person lacking knowledge, a person lacking boldness. But I look back at the cross and I look back at that empty tomb and I realize that everything that you expect of me, everything you desire to do through me, you can and you will. If I am but willing to be used by your Holy Spirit. So Lord, I pray with my brothers and sisters here this morning that you will do anything you want to do in me so that you can do everything you want to do in me.